That's Booker T. Jones. Booker T. and something. But Booker, it's that's Green Onions. He wrote that when he was 17 years old. And after that, from my point of view, he could have just retired. He's already done it. Now we're going to be speaking with Stephen Gowans. Gowans.wordpress.com is an article. The largely unrecognized U.S. occupation of Syria. I believe Stephen is with us. Are you there, Stephen?
Hello, yes. Hello, Phil. I'm here.
Yeah. Well, this is published March 11. You have raised a touchy issue. today, actually, it was some dramatic news. I noticed it. I checked my Toronto Star and Globe and Mail. They didn't run any photographs, but the president of Syria, President Assad, was in the area called East Ghouta visiting his soldiers and officers and also refugees. And Syrians are quite pleased, of course, at this development, since for some years now that East Ghouta has been the terrorists there have been firing shells into the city of Damascus, killing people. And is apparently the Syrian army is close to victory. But you're pointing out in your article that there's a new there's an issue that's going to the 800-pound gorilla called the United States, and they have put soldiers on the ground. And this is, in your view, is going to be a special kind of test. How extensive is this U.S. Presence?
Well, depends on how you want to measure it. And they've invaded, or the United States has invaded Syria with a significant military force. Now, how significant is it? Well, that's difficult to say. The United States acknowledges that there are 2,000 troops in the northeastern part of Syria, but it earlier said that there were 500 troops, and it revised this upward, calling its previous estimate an artificial construct, which is a euphemism for simply a misrepresentation of the truth. And this current number, 2,000, appears to be an artificial construct as well. It's an artificial construct because the 2,000 include only those who are counted. And it's acknowledged that there are a whole bunch of U.S. special forces and other forces that are not counted. So special operations personnel are not counted. Troops assigned to classified missions are not counted. Contractors or mercenaries the United States hired are not counted. Mm-hmm. Combat air crew, not counted. Mm. Combat air crew are very vital to the enforcement of the occupation. So it's unclear how many U.S. personnel are in Syria. And on top of the military personnel, there are also diplomatic personnel.
Mm-hmm.
Diplomatic personnel, working with the Kurds, which are their boots on the, well, they call them the boots on the ground.
So we have boots and suits.
Yes, boots and suits, and the suits are establishing new local government structures within this occupied territory.
And how legal is this, in your view, under international law?
Under international law, it's completely illegal. I mean, there's no question about that. The other question is it legal under U.S. law? Do they have authorization to use military force in Syria? And the justification that the White House and the Pentagon put forward is completely indefensible. The authorization they cite is based on a 2001 law, which authorizes the use of military force against the perpetrators of the September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
The 2002 law authorizing the invasion of Iraq. Now, they say that their presence in northeastern Syria is related to the war against ISIS. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's accept that. Let's assume that's the case. Well, if that's the case, there's still no authorization for the use of military force against ISIS. So they invoke the 2001 law that says that they can use force against al-Qaeda, saying that ISIS is essentially equivalent to al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
And the 2002 law authorizing the invasion of Iraq is completely irrelevant, since apparently, according to the Obama administration, the Iraq war is over.
Mm-hmm.
But none of these laws, these U.S. laws, authorize two other key objectives, which were articulated by the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. He said that there are three objectives for being in Syria. And he announced an indefinite occupation of northeastern Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And the objectives were, number one, to continue to combat ISIS. So there's an indefensible legal authorization presented for that. The second objective is to prevent the Syrian government from recovering its territory. Well, there's no legal authorization offered for that because there is no legal authorization for preventing the legitimate government from recovering its territory. And the third objective, he articulated, was to eclipse Iranian influence in Syria,
mm-hmm.
for which there's no legal authorization as well.
Could you tell me the third one again? I'm sorry.
To eclipse Iranian influence in Syria.
Well, how could they... Under international law, there isn't any provision for such a thing, right? You don't like some other country, and therefore you're going to put troops somewhere?
Exactly. Now, there's certain U.S. politicians who've noticed this and have sent letters to the both the Pentagon, to the Department of National Defense in the United States, and to the State Department and said, what's your legal justification? And the reply is, maybe the Secretary of State articulated three goals, but there's really only one goal. We're there for ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
So they quickly backtracked on that.
You know, you're telling me this reminds me of the Americans when they introduced torture in Iraq, and the lawyers went to work and found a way to talk about torture without calling it torture.
Mm-hmm.
It's just it's pretty much like the old gangster movies where you hire what they call the mouthpiece, and you do whatever you feel like doing, and then tell him, you figure it out. I'm paying you to create an excuse or something to get me off on this thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is Stephen Gowans, by the way. Gowans.wordpress.com. The article is The Largely Unrecognized U.S. Occupation of Syria. Incidentally, you point out, too, there seems to be a lot of oil where the U.S. put its troops.
Yes. So the territory they control contains most of Syria's oil and gas wealth and also most of its arable land.
Mm-hmm.
And the result of that is, and the other interesting thing about this was during the war against ISIS, the Syrian army and its allies focused on liberating cities.
Mm-hmm.
U.S. military planning or war planning emphasized the capture of oil and gas facilities. And they used their tip of the spear, the Kurds, to move south along the Euphrates, capturing oil and gas fields.
Mm-hmm.
And the result is that they now control most of the oil and gas wealth of the Syrian Arab Republic and have no intention of returning it.
Yeah, there is an echo, I think, of in that. I recall that when Donald Trump was first elected, he went to see the CIA, and he gave a little talk. We all watched him. It was a very peculiar Trump performance, as usual. But he did say about Iraq, we should have kept the oil.
Yeah.
We shouldn't have gone in, but once we're there, we should have kept the oil. Although, by the way, now we're talking about something rather hard to do. I noticed it, and you must have taken note of it, Foreign Minister Lavrov, he is saying what you're saying in that he says this is not a matter of using pawns, or I forget what the expression is, but he says this is actual U.S. direct involvement. He said they're not playing through third parties. They're there. So... by the way, when your foreign minister chooses to say that, he's known that for a long time. When he chooses to say it, it puts you in a different kind of problem or situation.
No, precisely, and he's right. I mean, the Kurds are simply used as this thin veneer behind which they can carry out this operation, which is illegal. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they don't want to draw attention to this illegal operation, so it's presented as, you know, kind of a Kurd operation with U.S. support. And there's a direct parallel in Yemen, where the war in Yemen is described as a Saudi-led war, but it's really a U.S.-led war. I mean, if you look at all of the documentation on who's running this war, it's the United States, not the Saudis. The Saudis provide pilots to drop bombs, but the United States is running the rest of the operation. And, I mean, it's providing warships for a naval blockade. It refuels Saudi bombers in flight. It collects the intelligence. Flies its own drones and planes over Yemen to select, bombing targets. In fact, there was even an article, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal today, about the operations center in Saudi Arabia, the operations center in which they run this entire war of aggression against Yemen. And within the operations center is a little room they call, I can't recall what they call what it is, but it's a glass room, and inside sit U.S. and British advisors. And the U.S. and British advisors tell them which targets to select.
Yeah, and by the way, and again, as Stephen Gowans, you cite a writer, Ibrahim al-Amin, making this very important point. He made it in relation to the U.S. decision to move its embassy. Yeah. And he said, look, that's U.S. policy. That's not Israeli policy. And it's U.S. policy in Yemen, and it's U.S. policy in Syria. That's kind of important to underline, isn't it?
Yes. And then his argument was, you know, Israel is simply a tool of U.S. foreign policy. And Israel wouldn't last a day without U.S. support and U.S. resources. And the same can be said about the Kurds, and the same can be said about the South, or Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Saudi Arabia is simply an extension of U.S. foreign policy, an instrument.
But yes, incidentally, the MSB, I think he's called, or is it BS, pardon me, he's BS, as I recall. He's in Washington to, I guess, probably receive instructions. Following your logic here, okay. I want to mention that people write about this, and I really congratulate you on your approach in getting the issues clear. I saw an article in The Guardian, I think, by Patrick Coburn, and he says, well, the best hope of the situation is that now Russia and U.S. are players in Syria. Therefore, they can probably bring off of some kind of settlement because they're great powers. But he's treating them as equivalent. You've pointed out the United States is not, by their own law, legally in Syria, nor by international law. Talk about the Russian situation.
Oh, I mean, you're right. The Russians were invited into Syria by the Syrians. So they're there legally, as are the Iranians. And yet the United States will rail against the Iranians and rail against the Russians, too, for exerting influence in Syria and the Middle East, challenging U.S. geopolitical primacy. I mean, they're quite open about this. If you read the Bush administration 2017 national security strategy, they complain bitterly about Russia being in Syria or Iran being in Syria, because this is challenging U.S. primacy and challenging U.S. power. And no one can challenge U.S. power.
Yeah, that's the kind of the loud or the visible fact, which we can't get politicians here to address. You can get them to talk about don't bomb East Ghouta because there might be a civilian hit. But no one, will not discuss the U.S. exercising its self-appointed power to kill Syrians and indeed Russians. About a month ago, and this is apropos of your article too, they kind of let it, they was a little boast that they thought they'd killed 100 Russian soldiers. Apparently, there were some Russian contractors, but in the area. But describe that, by the way. That's another, you just actually have to, you really want to say, we have to stop the discussion because you just said that you're defending yourself against aggression by Syria when you are in Syria. Okay. Speak to that. You wrote about that very nicely in the article.
Yeah, I mean, American troops, and this has been in the U.S. press, the American troops have carried out strikes against forces loyal to the Syrian government several times in 2017. So, I mean, this is an escalation. We've had a war which is a proxy war with the United States backing Islamist forces, which have been waging war against the Syrian army. And now we have U.S. forces waging war or attacking the Syrian army. And on February 7th of this year, the Syrian Arab Army and some allies attempted to recover a critical gas plant near Deir ez-Zor. And they were attacked by the U.S. invaders. But the way it was presented in the U.S. press was that the Syrians provoked or the Syrians threatened the Americans who had to retaliate in self-defense.
Yeah. Well, U.S., I guess the suits, the U.S. diplomats were in danger of being struck by Syrian weaponry in Syria. And if a, I guess an American diplomat is there, that's all you need to know.
Yeah, and the United States says that it has, it's not waging war against the Syrian Arab Army, not waging war against Syria. But, I mean, you could look at it this way. I mean, could Russia invade the United States west of the Colorado River, control the territory's airspace, as the United States does in Syria, plunder its resources, as the United States is doing in northeast Syria, establish new government and administrative structures to supplant the local state and federal authority, and then say, well, we don't seek war with the United States and its armed forces.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was attacked and it retaliated, could it convincingly say, well, we are simply, you know, defending ourselves against the provocation from U.S. armed forces? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is absurd. I mean,
yes.
These are American forces illegally in someone else's country attacking the armed forces of that country, which is operating within its own borders.
Yeah. Now, when you're talking to the U.S., it's like dealing with Captain Kidd or Blackbeard or somebody. It's kind of a pirate's logic. Last question here on this matter is I want to make sure you point out that this is actually a reconquest or recolonization, but there is a little team effort here because this used to be French and British area, but now the U.S. Has assumed the mantle. Is that right? I mean, clearly France and Britain are running interference or doing legwork for the Americans.
Yes, they are. It's a reimposition of empire. I mean, it's not the French empire anymore, but it is an empire, the U.S. empire, with the French and the British now absorbed into the U.S. empire.
Yeah.
It's certainly contrary to this great wave of decolonization that swept the world in the 20th century, and this appears to be an attempt to reverse that.
Yeah. Well, as if I read your article right, and this is Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com, maybe that era of decolonization is going to be resumed. Stephen, we're very grateful. It's a very good article, and we look forward to that book on Korea and seeing you visit Toronto.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And in the moments or two here, this is we don't have any announcements today, do we, Phil?
That tomorrow night in Hamilton at 7:30 at the New Vision United Church, the Stop the War group in Hamilton will be having a talk by Chris Black and tell me the professor's name again, Kutturfi.
Kibursi.
Kibursi.
Professor Kibursi, friend of the show.
Yes. We'll be talking about Korea and the
friend of the show.
The danger being posed to world peace by American adventurism in Korea.
Yeah. Very appropriate. By the way, some people say, oh, well, why talk about it now? There's going to be a meeting. Yeah, there could be a meeting. Yeah. Cross your fingers or maybe put your fingers in your ear. Who knows? We're actually in a very dangerous situation on the Korea thing. When they talk about talking and they're well-armed and they hate each other, you got to be careful that's when it's kind of like they say, you know, the two most dangerous times on a flight is takeoff and landing. And they claim we're in a landing phase. So everybody tighten your seatbelts and assume the appropriate position should we give you the signal. I want to just say, I congratulate the Syrian army. They have a right to defend themselves. Everybody's always talking about, oh, so-and-so has the right to defend. Syria had a right to defend itself. And did they have a domestic uprising? I don't know, but I know that the United States and France and Britain have no business there. And Saudi Arabia has no business providing weapons to people.
Phil, can I tell you about something that I noticed on a YouTube transmission that came from Syria? President Assad of the Syrian Arab Republic visited East Ghouta, where the fighting has not finished, and he was walking among the people, and I noticed he doesn't have any bodyguards. It's him, and he's meeting the soldiers, right?
Yeah.
And I thought, can you just see Trump or Mrs. May walking in a crowd like that with no bodyguards?
Yeah. Well, I saw the – incidentally, I'm glad you raised that point. Go to Sana, S-A-N-A, and you can see some of the footage. I would – disagree slightly. I saw some bodyguards, so maybe you and I went to different schools.
Certainly not the kind of thing you'd have surrounding
this
Trump.
One thing is clear.
Yeah.
He has the respect of his soldiers. He has the respect of the population because he's an Arab leader who stood up to a Western power that tried to dictate. And you don't have to be a political scientist to understand that when a great power threatens a smaller nation, the people will rally to their country. They love their country. Americans love to talk about we're number one and we love ourselves and we really outlove ourselves and we're, you know, all this stuff. Well, other people love their countries. Other people have self-respect. Does it ever occur to them? Self-respect of a nation? And they know that the Saudis armed these maniacs. And we've all seen them. They do cut off people's heads. They say, Alawi to death and the Christians to the coast. And I mean, this is a sectarian army financed and armed by the Saudis and the U.S. and France and everybody else. So good for the Syrians. They proved sufficiently cohesive as an ancient nation and know themselves as Syrians. Nobody invented them. And it wasn't the British who drew a line and said, these are Syrians. They know they're Syrians. And they defeated these guys or are defeating them. It's not over, as Stephen Gowans and others point out. It's definitely not over. However, our hearts should go out to them. And we should be ashamed that the Canadian government and others participated in trying to violate the sovereignty of the Syrian state. Anyhow, this has been the Taylor Report. And I want to thank Braden and Phil, who's Wednesdays, 6 to 8 p.m. And we'll see you next week.